You're listening to Farming News with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to another episode of the Irish Farmers Journal's Farming News podcast. News correspondent Noel Barden here as your host for this week, with news editor Amy Ford and news correspondents Rachel Donovan and Anne O'Donoghue also on the line. Stay tuned to hear the latest on the acres payment fiasco, an update on meal and straw prices, as well as what a former EU trade negotiator had to say last week on Mercosur and the trouble brewing between the EU and China on trade. Amy Ford, we'll head to you first. So acres again, it's on the front page this week. Is there any good news for farmers there in the payments front, or what way is the acres looking? What does the department have to say on it now?
Good news, Noel. I don't know. The department is saying that it expects 95% of balance and payments to be processed by the end of the month, but it then added that it predicts further repayment demands to be issued as applications are processed. So for anyone that doesn't know, payments were delayed under the scheme. Farmers were issued with interim payments, kind of a flat rate. And then obviously if that payment went above what you were entitled to under the scheme, you would then need to pay that back, aka clawback. So there's 8,600 farmers and acres who are limbo, who are now waiting for these balance and payments, which will then also obviously try and balance out the overpayment of the interim payment. So they're waiting for that. And then a further 6,975 have been issued with demands and to repay upwards of 12 million due in these overpayments. So there's 12 million euro that was overpaid. There was actually more overpaid, but obviously some of that has been paid back. But 12 million euro is outstanding at the minute. Department officials, they've said that there's mapping discrepancies, scorecard issues, scheme contract changes, and then outstanding queries under the Basic Income Support for Sustainability scheme that are to blame for the delays in the balance and payments. Darren Carty has figures in this week's paper that to date, just under 1,200 general and nearly over 5,500 cooperation farmers have been overpaid on their interim payment, and they're overpaid by an average of just over 1,700 euro. So, you know, it's not small money we're talking about here. Then in a further blow, look, farmers, many of them along the Western Seaboard who are involved in the cooperation measure, they're not going to receive payment for non-productive investments that they would have applied for way back last year. So they're not going to receive approval for them until the end of 2024. So that then also means that they're not going to receive payment for them in this year. So they applied in 2023, fully expecting approval earlier this year, and then obviously payment by the end of this year. That's not going to happen. It's going to be next year, apparently, when the payment is going to issue. And I suppose those NPIs, they're worth up to 3,500 euro per farmer. So again, you know, a key income to farmers in what has been a terrible year weather-wise, terrible year income-wise and so on. So they're delayed as well. The IFA Hill Farm Chair, Colleen Keneally, he said that farmers in Acres Cooperation, they've been sold a pup and that farmers are losing faith in the scheme. While the INHFA, they've called on the department to suspend plans to recover these overpayments, saying that the mapping issues could have a massive bearing on a farmer's final payment. Look, to end on good news, because I'm conscious this is a key scheme for farmers in terms of incomes. The department is saying that advanced acres payments for 2024 are due to begin in November. So there is some light at the end of the tunnel, but obviously a lot of outstanding issues for a significant cohort of farmers there as well in the scheme.
So it seems like if you are kind of up to date on the payments front, your money could start issuing in November. But if you're not sorted out, there's issues in the system that still need to be resolved before the money gets flowing, especially on those NPIs by the looks of it. And those NPIs as well, I suppose they were pitched as a means of improving your overall payment. So you'd get paid for the NPI, but that would increase your overall score and your payment could increase as the scheme went on. But with those delays, you'll have fewer years left to avail of those, the possibility of higher scores on the habitats. And I suppose if we're to park acres there for the minute, and no doubt there'll be some sort of a follow-up next week or in the next couple of weeks, and if we shift over to the dairy sector, you have a bit of a roundup on different co-ops and different processors' outlook on dairy prices, dairy markets. I suppose supplies are down. Is it looking like prices are going to increase any more?
So stable to firm is the description on the dairy price outlook, Noel, on that front. Milk volumes, look, in the year to date, they're down around 5%, with dairy buyers still trying to secure product, and as a result pricing should be stable to firm, that they're saying, that Ornua is saying, Tierlan expects milk volumes to finish up 5% lower this year than last year, and it has collected over 2.2 billion litres to date from farmers, and that's down around the 5%, as we said, on the same period in 2023. They are expecting higher back end volumes in the latter months of the year compared to obviously the hard start to the year that there was. In the southwest, Kerry Dairy Ireland, they're down 6% year on year. They anticipate that milk volumes will be down around 5%. declined 5% for the year on 2023. And then Carberry has seen some recovery in milk supply in the second half of the year. They're down 5.5% in the year to date, but they hope for the remainder of the year that it'll be in line with 2023. Look, I suppose all co-ops, co-ops have set milk price now as well for the month of August. Lakeland lifted earlier in the week and more will come on stream. Outlook-wise then, Ornu has an EU market outlook for September. It's raised concerns around blue tongue in Germany, France and Netherlands, but the impact of that on milk supply and obviously then on markets isn't clear yet. Global flows should turn positive as the year progresses, but annual output is likely to be flat, it said. And it appears that some European buyers are still short a product and still need to secure dairy products in a rising market, and they're expecting pricing to be stable to firm through September then. So hopefully it is positive news in the back end for the dairy sector.
Lakeland definitely kind of setting the tone there for last month's milk with that price rise. Hopefully there will be a few more co-ops to come forward this week that we'll have to report on. So thanks for that, Amy. And I'll head to yourself now, Rachel Donovan. In the office on Monday, you were flat out on the phone ringing around farmers and sellers and buyers of straw. And from the headline on page 3, it looks like 25 to 35 euro a bale from the field seems to be kind of the going rate in most areas, I suppose. How does it change across the country, and what way is the market moving? Are farmers keen to get straw now?
Yeah, I suppose this research, Noel, was done both on a personal basis and for a story for this week's paper. But listen, a lot of farmers are talking about straw at the minute. There's a lot of straw being baled. If you look there online, there's lots of straw for sale. But what I'm hearing is straw is making between 25 euros and 35 euros a bale from the field. And I have there in that story that, you know, there are prices as high as 55 euros being paid by farmers in the West for it to be delivered. I suppose those farmers in the West are heavily dependent on these traders or dealers who go to the likes of Wexford, South Tip, Kilkenny, those areas, buy straw, fill lorries with straw, and then they have it to be able to pass on. But I suppose, speaking to another farmer, a tillage farmer in Carlow, who sold bales for 25 euros a bale this week, I suppose I saw the ad and I saw underneath it he had sold. So I said, listen, I'll give this fella a ring and he might be able to give me a non-skewed angle on what bales are making. Because obviously you ring a lot of fellas and they'll tell you that they're making more than they actually are. But he said, I suppose he was quite scathing of these dealers who are buying these lorry loads of straw and selling them to farmers in the West at really overly inflated prices. As I said, he had straw advertised Tuesday morning at 25 euros a bale. He said he happened to add up 10 minutes before he got his first call, and within an hour he had the straw sold. And I kind of said, listen, you obviously could have got more if you wanted. He said he wouldn't. He sees that straw is making 40 euros a bale in places. He wouldn't like to do that to anybody. He's a livestock man himself. And he has often had his foot in that same shoe trying to buy straw. And, you know, he said he couldn't think of anything worse than giving 55 euros a bale for straw that's going to end up as dung not long after. So I suppose speaking to maybe a few of these dealers as well, a dealer based in Sligo said that he delivers straw to my area, which would be North Tipperary, Moneygall, for 55 euros a bale. So I suppose that's definitely the higher end of it, Noel. But there's lots of straw for sale. I don't think farmers need to be given that much. He said that big square bales, 8x4x3s, are making 95 euros a bale delivered, which just seems extortionate. Then on, I suppose, the small square bale market, obviously this is going to be driven by equine interest, depending on the area. You know, I looked there again this morning. There's lots of small square bales there advertised at 5 euros a bale, which is on the higher end as well. But generally between 3 and 4 euros a bale, and locally, that's what I'm hearing. And obviously, there are lower prices again, even being paid, Noel, by if you have a deal with a farmer. You know, I heard of small square bales making €2.50 a bale for local deals, as well as 20 euros a bale for round bales. So I would say it's not all what's when you look online, it's not all what it appears. And there is definitely value still in the market. And as I said, there is lots of straw for sale still.
The value seems to be going straight to the farmer and negotiating your price rather than going through a dealer, although that isn't possible for people in a lot of parts of the country, of course. And very briefly then, you've done another ring around on meal prices. I suppose, what way is it looking kind of heading into the back end of the year when people might be starting to think about feeding a bit more?
Yeah, so there's not an awful lot to say here other than that fee prices are to stay relatively stable and similar to what they were all summer. So maybe some farmers got away without having to feed any meal all summer, they might know, but those who do, it's going to stay relatively stable. And as one merchant said to me, steady as she goes, he described it. And the majority of the merchants I spoke to don't see it rising between now and Christmas. And I suppose the other important factor which will determine feed price is what grain price will be set at. So I suppose they're all sitting tight yet for now, depending on what grain price will be set at. There could be some reductions, maybe a fiver a ton here or there, but relatively stable, Noel, from here to Christmas.
So there's a bit of certainty there, if nothing else, for farmers on the meal price front. And I'll come to you as well on Animal Health Ireland's conference that was held this week. But just before we do, we'll have a brief word from our sponsor, Delaval.
Are you a dairy farmer considering upgrading your milking equipment in the coming years? Have you considered robotic milking? Are you interested in finding out how it would work for you? Delaval are working with Irish farmers to bring together a seamless robotic milking and grazing experience. Currently, Delaval are offering free on-farm consultations. To sign up, all you need to do is visit www.delaval.com, click on the VMS and grazing campaign page, and fill in your details on the form. We will also be attending the National Ploughing Championships, where you can chat to us in person.
So you have as well in this week's paper, Rachel, that mastitis could be costing Irish dairy farmers €100 million a year. That's a fairly big figure. Where did it come from and what was the kind of commentary around it?
Yeah, it's a huge figure, Noel. I suppose it was mentioned at the Animal Health CellCheck conference in Kilkenny on Wednesday morning. And it came from Dr. Lawrence Chalou from Chagask. And he just said it's actually costing farmers over €100 million. And that's been for the last couple of years. And in 2014, it cost over €80 million, even though since 2014, there's been a lot less cases of mastitis and cell counts have reduced significantly on Irish farms. But it's still a huge cost and it's going up. And as I said, despite cell count going in the right direction. So he also just mentioned there how cell counts dropped from a peak of 272,000 in 2009 to a low of 175,000 in 2017. Now, they are actually creeping up slightly again, and which Shalou said was worrying. You know, they don't really know why they got those big reductions post 2009, and they also don't really know why it's starting to creep back up now, not to alarming levels, but he did say it was worrying and I suppose slightly concerning, you know. And this was the biggest cost here, Noel, with high cell count on farms, which farmers often forget about, is the reduction in yields. So the farmers, they'll see the penalty on their milk checks. They'll see how much it costs for their antibiotics or treatment from a vet call out. But they often forget, obviously, culling cows is the 46% of the cost associated with mastitis on farms. But the reduction in milk yield accounts for 40% of the costs associated with mastitis. So he just said that's an important one that the farmers often overlook.
And Anne, I'll move to yourself. You were at the Agricultural Science Association conference last week as well. A lot of conferences on this week. One of the speakers that caught a lot of headlines was John Clark, who is a former EU agri-food negotiator. There was a lot of strong lines from him and strong commentary on both the possibility of an EU-Mercosur free trade agreement and I suppose what you could call rising tensions between the EU and China on trade. From an EU point of view, China has dairy exports in its sights. What were the main kind of takeaway messages that you got from his speaking at the ASA conference?
Yeah, no, so it was really, he was one of the more interesting speakers, I suppose, at the ASA conference. Just given, I suppose, his background, as you said, they are former chief EU agricultural trade negotiator. You know, that gives what he says a lot of weight. On the, I suppose, the China tensions, some of this is quite positive, which is good. You know, he said that he didn't think it was something that Irish farmers should worry about, as I suppose that has been pointed out in the past on this. You know, this is in response, I suppose, to proposed EU tariffs on electric vehicles. And he was saying that it's more symbolic and political than anything else. And again, reiterated that he doesn't think it's something that Irish farmers should worry about. He said that, as far as I'm aware, it's a Sherlock Holmes quote, and that it's the dog, that this will be the dog that didn't bark in the night, meaning that, you know, it's kind of more posturing than anything else. He said that he thinks there will be a small anti-subsidy duty imposed on EU dairy, that, but it won't be significant. And basically, Noel, kind of that this will blow over, and that, as I said, it's more posturing than anything else, which I suppose is something that Irish dairy farmers definitely want to hear. It's a lot going on at the moment on farms. The last thing they need is, I suppose, any kind of major implications from trade with China. That said, though, you know, that was positive. But interestingly, when talking then about EU global trade in general, Noel, he seems to really like his books and films, John Clarke, because he did say, quoted great Game of Thrones. And for anybody who's watched Game of Thrones, one of the more famous phrases from the TV series, winter is coming, which if you haven't watched it, just means that things aren't going to be great. So basically said that in general, he thinks the kind of, you know, it's going to be a rocky 5 to 10 years for EU global trade. He said that, like, from his opinion, the days of open trade in terms of global European trade has already disappeared. And that kind of that realignment towards more sustainability goals for Europe, and that their trading partners are already pushing back on that. So I suppose two sides of the coin there, Noel, on trade in terms of China and just in general, negative and positive. Then I suppose, as you kind of touched off just there, he also talked about the Mercosur deal. You actually interviewed him in depth on this, Noel, as well, so I don't want to come in any of this do. But that was probably the more catching headline of the two, because he said the farmers shouldn't get their knickers in a twist over a Mercosur deal, which, look, I think the dairy farmers might be happy with the other headline about China, but I don't think beef farmers would be too happy about the Mercosur headline. And he just, again, said he just didn't think of something for that Irish or EU beef farmers need to worry about, that it just won't be that impactful. Mercosur has been one of those long-run issues, I suppose, the farmers, it's been in the back of their minds, have been concerned with. He outlined a number of reasons why he didn't think farmers should worry about it. Said the quota is going to be quite small, and said there's clauses in there that if trade does get disrupted, that the EU can, you know, pull back on things, and also that they could balance out if it was affecting farmers' incomes, that they could balance them out. All range and range of things are all included in the paper. But interestingly, the ICSA, the Irish Cattle and Sheep Farmers Association, were there on the day. They stood up, they pushed back on it because it was really interesting to get that two sides of the dialogue there, Noel, and said, while, you know, the quota is quite small and it's going to be phased in over 7 years, that at the end of the day, once you get the foot in the door, that, you know, more and more can come in. So the two sides of that presented there, I definitely wouldn't say it was an argument. That wouldn't be fair to say, but it's definitely dialogue on two sides that there, which was good, especially from a farmer's point of view.
Yeah, I'd say it was definitely one of the points of view that came up that was maybe what you might call the most controversial, or the one that sparked the most debate. I suppose beef farmers would say that they're facing so many challenges that even what might be on the grand scale of EU beef production a small challenge is just another cut that they're facing. It's another thorn in the side. And I'd imagine that they're, as you mentioned, there wouldn't have been a lot of happy beef farmers reading that headline, but they were the views of John Clarke anyways. And that was definitely one of the lines from the ASA conference that got quite a bit of debate. Now, earlier on this week, news correspondent James Hanley was speaking to Dr. Jean Beagle Ristiano over in the States about the possibility of a strain of blight coming to Ireland that is fungicide resistant, that has cropped up elsewhere in the world. So we'll have a little bit to hear about what this researcher had to say.
My guest joining me this week is Professor Jean Ristiano, who hosted a lecture on the Irish famine pathogen at the Royal Irish Academy this week. Good afternoon, Jean.
Good afternoon, James. Nice to be here.
I guess to start, coming from universities in Maryland, California, Davos and North Carolina State, what brought your research to Ireland?
Well, I have spent most of my career working on the pathogen that caused the Irish potato famine. I'm a William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor at North Carolina State University. We have late blight on both tomatoes and potatoes in North Carolina and elsewhere in the U.S., and it causes severe outbreaks. So I've been doing research in the area and on that pathogen for a number of years.
So yes, I understand that you've more than 25 years experience just even as a full professor. What attracted you to Phytophthora pathogens? Forgive me if I've also pronounced that wrong.
Well, Phytophthora. It's pronounced Phytophthora, and the word Phytophthora means plant destroyer. I, as a master's student at the University of Maryland, started working on Phytophthora when we had a soil-borne Phytophthora, P. soji, affecting soybeans in Maryland on the Eastern Shore. When I graduated with a master's and went out to UC Davis, I worked on a different Phytophthora species, Phytophthora parasitica, which is a soil-borne Phytophthora that kills tomatoes. A lot of the processing tomatoes in the U.S. come from the West Coast. Hunts and Heinz have, they have plants out there where they process and make tomato paste. And this pathogen is a real problem on the roots of tomatoes. When I got to North Carolina as an early assistant professor, we had several other Phytophthora problems, including P. infestans on potatoes and tomatoes. So I started working on Phytophthora infestans. It's a real challenge. It's a problem, threat to global food security. It never disappeared after the famine, as growers in Ireland know well. It's still here and aggressive as ever.
And I guess looking at the famine that happened in Ireland in the 1800s, what can you say? What brought the potato famine to Ireland? And was there similar events across the world?
Well, I've been doing a lot of research. I'm here on a Fulbright fellowship, and I'm working on a book called The Potato Plague. So I've been doing a lot of reading of historical literature and also analyzing data from past outbreaks. And the disease originated from our research, DNA and genetic analysis. It originated in the Andes of South America. It migrated into the U.S. in between 1843 and 1845. We had severe outbreaks around Philadelphia, New York, and the upper northeast of the United States. It spread from a five-state area into 11 or 12 different states and into Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island in Canada. So the blight was in the U.S. 2 years before it hit Ireland in 1847. And, you know, we've been using historic outbreak samples from plant herbaria, like the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin and Kew Gardens, to track the spread of the pathogen of the original famine lineage.
And I guess, as you said, part of your research here in Ireland and the work you're doing, to my knowledge, you're doing some of that with the Department of Agriculture. Just in terms of food security, what kind of work are you doing with them?
Well, with my colleague, Dr. Richard O'Hanlon, who's the director of the plant sciences group there that's in the division at Department of Ag, Food, Marine, we've been working on a project on Phytophthora ramorum. Phytophthora ramorum is a different Phytophthora species that's entered Ireland in the early 2000s on rhododendron, probably ornamental rhododendrons brought into gardens, home gardens, and then it migrated into Japanese larch, and it's pretty much infected large scale, large production in the country, and has really kind of forced the industry to start planting resistant trees like Sitka spruce and other tree varieties or tree types. So we're with Richard's group, we've been genotyping the ramorum collections. He has 20 years worth of samples, and also Northern Ireland, AFBI in Northern Ireland has collections as well. So we're trying to study how that more recent invader into Ireland has spread through the country and understand the genetic diversity of Phytophthora ramorum.
And I guess you're talking about some of the newer strains being noticed in Ireland and being reported on, and many of our listeners would have heard through the recent EU24, is it, strain? 43, apologies. Of course, Irish growers are just well versed on such problems. And I guess, is there any worries that this could be a major problem for growers in Ireland in the future?
So this May, I attended a meeting of the Euroblight research community, and it also included government, academic, and industry researchers. And this EU43 strain was first found in Denmark several years ago. And what's difficult about that particular strain of Phytophthora infestans is that it's resistant to a fungicide that a number of growers use, mandipropamid. And this is a fungicide that's been around for a long time. It's a multi-site fungicide, and no one thought that this pathogen could become resistant to it because it's not a single-site spectrum, single-site mode of action chemical. But in Denmark, they have very diverse populations of Phytophthora infestans that are very aggressive, and they have sexual populations that are reproducing fast. And this resistance occurred in the EU43 strain. And so screening has been going on here in Ireland. Stephen Kildea and the group at Chalsic down in Carlo, and David Cook at Scottish Crops Research Institute, or James Hutton, it's called now, Institute in Scotland, have been genotyping, and they did find it late last year. They published a paper late in the season, so they're keeping their eye out for it. It's not here, and it's here, but it's not widespread like it is in Denmark, but it's something to be concerned about. So the folks, the researchers here in Ireland are looking at different kinds of chemistries and recommending mixtures of fungicides to control late blight rather than using single compounds to prevent resistance from developing.
And as you say, your work doesn't just focus on the history of how these pathogens cause outbreaks. It's also about prevention into the future. And looking at that, how much of your work would you be using genotyping in terms of prevention?
Well, our lab, since about 2009, we've been genotyping Phytophthora populations in the U.S., P. infestans populations. We use the same markers that the European groups are using. In fact, we're using their same system. It's called microsatellite genotyping. And we have fewer strains in the U.S. Our populations are clonal, and we've been monitoring them for, you know, since 2009. My lab also maintains a surveillance system called usablight.org. And the USA Blight system, when a disease is reported, growers or researchers, extension will report the location, county level. We never indicate a grower's farm, but we report on the county level. And then that alert is sent out to growers if they request to be on the alert system, and it's a warning for them to begin spraying. There are weather-based disease forecasting systems, but this system is based on, if you have the right weather but don't have the pathogen, you won't get disease. So you want to make sure you know when the disease is in the area and you have the conducive weather. So USA Blight allows us to monitor where outbreaks occur, and to also, we monitor fungicide resistance of the strains that we have. In the US, we have one strain right now. It's called US23. And it's sensitive to most of the fungicides that are used in Europe and the U.S. We haven't found resistance in this particular strain, but we're keeping our eye out because of what's happening in Europe.
And how much of your work is done on this molecular level? Would you be doing much gene editing?
Gene editing. No, I don't do... I use CRISPR-Cas technology in my laboratory, but not for breeding. We've used CRISPR technology and CRISPR is basically a gene editing tool, an enzyme that does very specific cuts in DNA, and you can use it in detection of pathogens. And we developed a CRISPR assay for detecting a resistance-breaking strain of the tomato spotted wilt virus that's a real problem on tomatoes and lots of different crops globally. So we're using CRISPR tools for diagnostics, but we have others in our department in North Carolina State that are doing gene editing of crop plants to try and improve them for disease resistance.
And we covered my questions here, but is there just any other elements of your work that you'd like to discuss?
Well, one thing I would just like to say, you know, I have a broad interest in this pathogen that caused such havoc in Ireland during the famine era. And the collections that were done in 1845 by researchers, David Moore at Glasnevin at the Botanic Gardens, and researchers in England, those collections are very important. The National Botanic Garden here in Glasnevin has mycological and plant collections. And what's valuable about those historic collections is that you can use them to track epidemics of the past. You can use them to understand plant biodiversity in the past. And I just, that they have been an integral part of a lot of my research in tracking the spread of this plant killer, Phytophthora infestans. And I just want to kind of wave the flag for maintaining historical collections. And, you know, I just was in Kew last 2 weeks ago, and the Kew Gardens plant collection is being moved from the gardens to, there's talk of moving it to a remote site outside the botanic gardens. And it's just really, you know, some of these collections have been lost. Duke University just dispersed their entire collection, but they are valuable time capsules, and we need to understand modern day epidemics. We need to be looking at past epidemics, and so I think they're very valuable resources. And being here in Ireland the last 6 months has been a wonderful opportunity for me to develop a greater understanding about the impact of the famine on the Irish people. Learn about their culture and hopefully complete a book on the potato plague that I'm really interested in getting published in the next 6 to 8 months.
And I guess just to finish up on the book, how far has it come along so far? How long have you been working on it? And as you say, you hope to have it done in the next 6 or so months.
I have been working on it earnestly since I've been here. I've been collecting material for my book for years. I mean, through my career, little by little. And as I've actually done research, I've documented through different publications over time, bits and pieces of the history of this pathogen, but I'm now putting it all together. And I have 7 of 10 chapters done. So I'm 70% there. So I'm feeling good about it. And, you know, sometimes you have to remove yourself from your day-to-day academic job to be able to write, and I was able to do that here, particularly with the Irish weather. Sitting inside behind my laptop writing has been a great place, and Ireland's known to a lot of great writers have come out of Ireland, so I've just really enjoyed being here writing the book.
Which has been the hard part, the research or the writing?
The research has definitely been more challenging because we started out working on, you know, ancient DNA work on samples from 180 years ago. So there were a lot of uphill battles just to get the funding, to get the processes, the procedures in the lab to work right. Writing, you know, it's just flowing now from my experiences and my science over time. And so the writing is really been fun. I'm enjoying it.
And I guess there's many Irish growers here that would like to thank you for waving the flag for them. And I just want to thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
That definitely does sound like a cause for concern for Irish potato growers. And with that said, that's all we have time for this week, folks. Make sure to pick up your copy of the Irish Farmers Journal for more. We'd like to thank Delaval for supporting this podcast. And thanks to you, the listener.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.